problem, Martin.
Start it and see if more people are going to trickle in as they start waking up and getting breakfast. I'm Tom Henry with the Toledo Bling about Western Lake Erie algae myself, but I brought Alicia Smith here to do that. Me, I never knew my career would be so hyper-focused on algae and the poisons that it produces. And I'm sure Alicia will tell us that she never expected her life to change the way it has. But this isn't just a Toledo-based panel. To galvanize people into action and what, you know, certain groups of people get a disproportionate brunt of pollution, what they do about it. I mean, Kristen Schlemmer, right next to Alicia here, she's an attorney with Bayou City Waterkeeper, who, regarding sewage community where, some of the disadvantaged people live, and she's going to explain, how that legal effort came to be and how they were able to succeed in that respect. I don't know if you'll be able to join us, Reverend, a very well-known, very highly regarded community organizer here in Houston who, is involved with helping to fix lead lines and other issues. But even if he's not here, I had a wonderful chat with him. He seems like a very warm person and he's very, very inspired to try to help people. And at the far end, we have Mustafa Santiago Ali, who, if you were at the Pittsburgh conference in 2017, he was one of our keynote speakers. Mustafa graciously agreed to come back. He's a national expert on environmental justice and equity issues, having done so for the USC and others, and now working privately on campaigns. Easy to get, this panel when SEJ asked me to do it, because I actually studied environmental justice at Vermont Law School, and I've always had, and I think this gets to the core of why we get into journalism in the first place, is try to give a voice to some of the people who have trouble. It's more of a chance, kind of feeling depressed. People who are mobilized and fighting the good fight. It's something that has to be fought to keep public officials accountable and to have people see things the way that they may not otherwise see certain situations. So I'll stop rambling and I won't promise that, but for now I will, and I'll let Alicia Smith. Toledo suddenly declared a first of its kind water crisis because of a Western Lake Erie algal bloom. Keep in mind, this is it got worldwide coverage because we're right on the edge of the world's greatest collection of fresh surface water, and a metropolitan area of 500,000 people suddenly had no fresh water for its people. So go ahead, Alicia.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. I first want to just give some back to reduced lunch. The schools that surround that community are a poverty-stricken community within the inner city of Toledo, Ohio. However, that did not stop the activism to protect public health in the public health crisis of the algal bloom that took place in 2014, leaving over 500,000 people without their water. We have four pillars that we live by and stand on. Those are social justice, environmental justice, peace, education, and economic justice. The first being social justice, because the voice of the people are the most important in regards to democratic education, democratic society. if you're having something done to you, you should know exactly what that is. So we have a motto of nothing about us without. Imagine what that looked like in 2014 when you wake up in the morning at 2 o'clock in the morning and find that you cannot drink, touch, bathe in your water. You cannot provide milk for your children because you, for those that have babies, needed formula. For your elders who don't have good sight and those different things, waking up and preparing coffee and having a green film. And if we had not activated our community at 2 o'clock in the morning, many of those families would not have had water at their homes. And so what we had to do in order to keep social justice in 150 miles to get bottled water to the families in that community, at least 8,000 residents. Environmental justice. That's something that we just use and kind of throw around, but what is the definition? And we had to make sure people understood. It is your right to say of a number of things that protect you, and yet our systems and our politicians failed us. And that is not something that we just thought about. It was something we were experiencing. And now we're going to add the burden of a disparity of water, food insecurities, and health crisis. So those are the things that led us to movement of community participatory action. It wasn't about you doing something without us being in the room. So we began to go to city council meetings and ask for questions, and not only ask the questions, but actually propose legislation to change things. We actually had a number of legislative things accepted in regards to our policy reform. Not only did we ask why we weren't getting immediate SRF support, so state research around what grants were available. We began to help and write into the municipal codes of what it is the community could do, such as door-to-door canvassing around what to do when algorithms take place, door-to-door canvassing around sampling and citizen science, so that our children of African-American descent, BIPOC communities, would have that education, whether their schools were low economic or otherwise. Then for those of our counterparts of the macro culture who did not have the same privileges, because this was not just a black issue. This was an issue of life. These were low socioeconomic Caucasians. That made an environmental issue that went beyond. So in that, we had not only, at the time that we got to our house, we're knocking and bamming, Mama Johnson, answer your phone. Mama Johnson, answer your door. When she came to that door, she had already, her routine, boil the water, because you can't boil. She can't. It becomes more toxic. It's a neurotoxin. It is researched. She came to the door, and we said, oh, no, put that coffee down. Why can't I drink my coffee? What's wrong with you? Well, Mama, it's not good for you. And had our children not been engaged at that level. So it has to be multi-generational. It has to be multi-racial. It has to be multi-purpose and multifaceted for community participatory action to work. So that's Junction.
Very good, thanks. So Kristen, why don't you tell us what BioCity or Bayou City Waterkeeper is, and then also what inspired you to act on behalf of residents here in Houston after Hurricane Harvey.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Kristen Schlemmer. Waterkeeper is based here in Houston. Our whole work here, and one thing that we don't recognize enough living here is that we're not just diverse in terms of who lives here, but we're also really diverse in terms of the ecosystems around us. There's a ton of biological diversity here. And our work at Bayou City Waterkeeper focuses on water and, recognizing that diverse and pleasure of all kinds and wanting to make sure that water is. And as a lawyer, I'm very focused on finding problems that we can tackle by using the law, and often that's the clean lift that up too before I shift more into the problems. But we have had a culture for a long time of not doing enough to tackle sources of environmental pollution here. So there's a lot of, from a legal perspective with water, there's so much low-hanging fruit. And there's a lot of issues people just know have been problems for years. And the question that we have to ask is, why isn't anyone doing anything about them? And so one of those problems was the city of Houston. The city of Houston has 39 wastewater treatment plants. Each of those had a wastewater permit issued under the Clean Water Act's regulatory scheme. There were reporting requirements anytime they had a sanitary sewer overflow from their system, and that's anytime sewage was had to report it to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. So we have records of it. 9,000 times over 5 years that the city of Houston had not been able to get sewage to one of its wastewater treatment plants for processing. And regulators about this. There's going to be a solution any day. There's supposed to be a consent decree any day. And this was the story for years. So what Bayou City Waterkeeper did as an organization, the Clean Water Act. Another thing that we did was, the Clean Water Act, really, when it comes down to it, it's concerned about, violations of the act, which is just happening, who it's happening to. So that was another thing that was, and a lot of this actually was based on some of the data from the city of Houston and found that there was a disproportionate impact on, if you lived in a zip code that was lower wealth, blacker, or browner, you were likelier to experience a sewer overflow. So we kind of updated that analysis, added some more metrics in, and said, yes, that's right, sort of in the narrative and in our discussions with all of these government regulators. So anyway, this was in 2018 that we've served the city of Houston with a notice of intent to sue. Many of you may know that there's a 60-day waiting period before we can actually sue once you serve the notice. And EPA decided to take enforcement action on day 50 and continued to... The great thing about the EPA kind of taking the wheel with enforcement is allowing transparency, making public engagement better. And the result of all of this was last year, almost a year ago to the day, actually, it was March 31st, 2021, a federal court here in town approved the consent decree that will now require the city of Houston to comprehensively upgrade its it has to make specifically address communities that are bearing a disproportionate burden of sewer pollution. But some of the consent decree doesn't address this. And so that's where we as an organization remain focused, not necessarily on the legal front, but more on an advocacy front and community organizing front. I think I'll stop there. I know I could talk forever, but I think that kind of gives you good background.
Over the Flint water crisis, like a lot of other people, I didn't get as much time, but I went for 3 or 4 days and... it was outside of our circulation area, so I didn't cover it as intensely as some other people. But my boss checked in with me at one point after I'd been there for a couple days, asked, how's it going? And I said, I've got one word for you. That word is offensive. I said, I just can't believe, seeing this with my own eyes in person, people in the United States or even anywhere in the world are treated like this, with the kind of lead contamination that they were exposed to, who's had the unique, position of being on the inside with US EPA and also now as a, activist consultant going around and finding some of the problem areas around the country and just wondering, what Mustafa, maybe you could shed light for us journalists here on what are some of the stories we're missing and what can we do stories on environmental justice, but what are some of the ones that we could do to, put a more of a human face on this issue?
Sure. First of all, thank you all for allowing me to hold space to you communities now across our country as I'm outside. I think the best way to illuminate these injustices that are happening across our country, and of course outside of our borders as well, is I'm going to ask everybody to close your eyes for 1 second. And hopefully I can help you to take a journey. So when we talk about the impacts that are happening in relationship to water, I want you to remember this fact, that you can live without water for only a few days, but we continue to ask black and brown and indigenous people and lower wealth communities to live and survive with it for decades. That's the dynamic that we're currently dealing with. And, you know, we often say that water is a human right. El agua es un derecho humano. The reality of the situation is that you can't live with water, without water, but how long can you live with toxic water? This is toxic water that is all throughout Appalachia, from Institute, West Virginia, where they're trying to place additional plants there that are going to impact the water, to the runoff that has been happening with people who have no voice because they were raised in a culture of the mine owns. And overlay that over in Imperial Valley in California, where farm workers are also caught in this dynamic where they are being exposed from agricultural runoff, from pesticides. I felt, or in California, the way we thought it was unimaginable that folks had to go out and buy water. Yes, it was definitely dealt with heavy metals in our water. Of course, the power plant that was right across the street, right across the river, didn't help at all. When you ask me about the stories that you shared with the colonists or the colona, but yet we won't invest in the communities. And this is a part of the history of our country that we have to tell, not that we get angry. So when my dear brother was talking about Flint, Michigan, there were over, when we were going through that, and I was there, there were 3,000 locations across our country that had higher levels of lead in the water than Flint did. Mm-hmm. And this is both in the urban and the rural context. So with all of the editors that I work with, I'm like, how could you not grasp hold of these stories? They're better than anything. Unfortunately, they're tragic. But there is also triumph in many stories that we don't highlight of what's happening in these communities and how folks are navigating. There are stories in Puerto Rico about, you know, the impacts that have been happening in relationship to water, but how folks have been creative and being able to redirect their limited resources to be able to make change. Now, let me preface also by saying that there are still huge things, and folks shouldn't have to get creative. We basic amenities. But let me give you a deeper flavor because, you know, for those of us, so I grew up in two places. I grew up in Appalachia and I grew up in Michigan. And when you look at the dynamics of how folks are using our tax dollars to redirect to communities that they see value in, mm-hmm. and not in the communities that need the real dollars out there for us to do the right thing. So there has to be real intentionality in there. When we saw the stories that came out recently about how folks are seeing, mm-hmm. it was infused into transportation policy. It was infused into housing policy. It was infused actually also into environmental policy because as important and foundational as the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and RCRA and a number of these other acts are, think about when they were created. It wasn't like folks were embracing black and brown and indigenous folks in the 1970s. We knew, we saw the Cuyahoga River catch on fire. Say all that to say that because they were saying, well, there are a bunch of black folks there, so let's do something. So I say all that to say that we like when positive things are happening, but also the gap that still exists. I forget what the exact number is, so, and I know I'm in a room full of reporters, so I think it was about 63 million people who were dealing with unsafe drinking water over the last decade. Now, that was from a couple of years ago. There have been some changes that have happened in that space. If we understand that, there was another study that came out a couple of years ago that talked about, well, of those 63 million folks who are dealing with unsafe drinking water, who are the folks who are most in danger? When you began to unpack that, there were about 25 million folks, and it was Latinx folks or Latinos and Latinas, for those who use different descriptors in that space, African-American folks, and indigenous brothers and sisters. Let's go deep. You want the stories. The stories are on our reservations. How many folks in the room have ever spent any time on reservations? So the infrastructure. People often hear me talk about revitalizing vulnerable communities, moving from surviving to thriving. Our indigenous brothers and sisters who are on a number of reservations are literally in survival modes. So we know how many nations and tribes there are out there. Of course, everybody is not necessarily on a reservation. Go to the reservations, but spend time understanding the culture that exists there. And how the culture is tied to water. Go talk about the real black belt. I'm sorry, y'all. I'm going to give real talk. I tell folks, don't invite me if you don't want real talk. Because there are solutions for us to do it. But we got to get to what the real issues are. When you go to the black belt, or you go to many of the reservations also have, because of sovereignty, they have some different dynamics that are going on. But when you go to the black belt, You've got communities where the average annual income of folks, $10,000, $11,000, $13,000 a year in our country. Right now, where a loaf of bread might cost you $6. The reason I give you that context is because if we are asking folks to pay more and more for water that they may not trust, and rightly so, who are making $10,000, $11,000, $12,000, $13,000 a year, how do their small systems actually, are they able to be able to compete in a capacity that we do? So there are a number of stories, all the way up from Turkey Creek, Mississippi, and y'all have heard Derek Evans' story. There's a water story that is there that is tied to culture, that is tied to freedmen communities, that is tied to success because of the work of the folks that are there, all the way coming back up through Georgia. I mean, I won't take too long. I can give y'all 50 stories just in the Black Belt. You find folks like in Florence, South Carolina, or around the Little Petey River, and the impacts that are happening to the elders there as the wells and systems get overwhelmed because of these storms that continue to come through, or these just amazing rain events that we now see. So there are a laundry list of stories to question in part. When I first started doing this work, I couldn't get reporters to pay attention to what was going on. Now, of course, when I first started, I was just a student also, so of course nobody's paying attention, but over the years, it was so incredibly difficult to get. We used to, and they're across the country, what they share? Imagine that. Tens of thousands of communities across our country and not being able to do that. I want to shout out someone. I'm going to shout out also when I do this thing at noon. Brent Mock. Brent Mock was a reporter who was willing to actually tell, but he also spent time with folks. And you got to do that if you want them to be real authentic. How many folks in here knew what was happening in the Fifth Ward? We have one person, one and a half, with over 200 reporters. Imagine we're coming to a city where communities have been fighting for decades, that if we, who help to tell stories, well, most reporters wouldn't say they just tell stories, of course, helping to highlight the narrative, then we have a responsibility to be able to dive deeper. And we have a responsibility also to continue to work with our editors, I've done that, and trying to help to give you guys the space that you need, the time, and the resources, because I understand the resources is a big, big impediment many times in you being able to do some of the things that you need to do. And I'll go deeper into some of the other stuff, but I don't want to take too much time.
Throw out the first question here in the Q&A, and it's kind of a broad question, but there's something about maybe the older I get, the more empathetic I get towards people, but I've always kind of wondered, you know, we're taught in kind of a macro level, people say to me like about, you know, and obviously there's racism in every in a lot of facets of life, but, you know, people like for Flint, for example, they would, you know, maybe say like, oh, they're just trying to get more. They're trying to, you know, get what they can. I said, they're human beings, man. They're not asking for a new country. There's always the cynicism that somebody's in on trying to get something else, you know, and with the police union. But I said, of a service that government provides, argument over. Tell me what's more important than clean water. I mean, public safety's up there, a bad road system or whatever here and there, but you can't live without clean water. And why aren't we making that a bigger priority? And in Toledo, we even had the roof caving in. You know, everybody knows about institutional racism, and we're learning more of things that we, you know, may not have known before. How much do you think sheer arrogance plays into the cynicism people have about just, when it comes down to, like I said, to clean water. Yeah. You know, anybody, go ahead.
I mean, I'm surrounded by lots of scientists, some of the best programs that you present scientists, along with a couple other places. I like to bring it down to the base level, folks. One of my mentors said, So here's what you do. When somebody says what you said, they're just good. By a show of hands, whatever your dominant hand is, raise your hand. So from that sort of base question, and you start to break it down into, should we pay more to make sure that everybody has safe drinking water? Then a few hands will go down. And then if you ask the question, should we pay more to make sure that whichever group you want to identify or however you want to do it, that's when you start to see the biases play in. Okay? And of course, Omega Wilson from Wira Inc. Down in North Carolina, Bevan, North Carolina, often talks about basic amenities. We have to remind folks that these are about the basic building blocks. Should be the basic building blocks, yes, of humanity, the basic building block of health. But then we should also ask the question, is it a basic building? And when we begin to help people to get past some of the things that separate us, then I think that we have some place to operate from. It's amazing that folks forget that communities in Flint, that communities in Benton Harbor, Michigan, have higher levels of lead in their water than folks in Flint did, both in West Virginia, folks here in Houston. I mean, folks aren't giving less places. They're paying taxes. So folks aren't giving you anything. Here's the dynamic on decades upon decades. And the investments weren't coming back to their communities. So all we're doing in this moment is that these aren't reparations. Mm-hmm. These are folks that black and brown and indigenous and lower wealth white communities continue to carry without receiving taxes and back to our basic humanity, our basic amenities. Excuse me, I only got 3 hours of sleep last night.
Do you have anything you want to add, Alicia? Go ahead.
I just want to lift the fact that there's so many contaminants, and these contaminants are not just not good for your body, but your mind, and they impact our children as well as our elders. You have a new toxin, microcystis is not something that you can even consume. But lead, there is zero amounts of lead that is safe for human consumption. We talked about Benton Harbor. You can look all over the Great Lakes region. You have fresh water everywhere, but you don't have any access. And neither is it affordable. In Toledo, due to the algal blooms, compared to Rightford, and the community had to help. And now we're paying 168% more for our water. And instead of having monthly bills, we went to quarterly bills. So who's the poverty pimp then? And then we do a poverty study that says that there's no way that families can continue to buy. What are we doing? And where's the report card on the politicians that continue to fail us? That's what we've done in our community. Enough is enough. You get tired of being sick and tired. You watch your children. When we talk about cognitive disabilities and we talk about the crime, we did that historically. When we didn't protect folks, when we didn't put in mandates and regulations within the Clean Water Act and looking at the Farm Bill and all, these are the number one lead for the school to prison. It's a pipeline. The private prison complex is a pipeline. And who's benefiting? It's definitely not the communities that we say are disadvantaged. We have the ARPA funds and we don't have a clue how they're being allocated. We have Justice 40 with no regulations of what you should be doing for community. Don't just sit and allow things to happen. And when you lift the stories, you can lift the stories with a story back, where it's the same thing all over the ground. You are dying daily to environmental injustices. You are the most important people in the world.
Did you have anything to add, Kristen?
Yes. So I just also want to take that in too. I think just going back to your question about sheer arrogance, the first thing that, or whether, how does sheer arrogance play into this? The first things that popped into my mind were Hurricane Harvey and Winter Storm Uri, and just thinking about how people, thinking about what Mustafa said, like in terms of how people like are willing to empathize and like, you know, start to add money about water being a right, changes when you start to add money to the conversation. And so like with Harvey and Yuri, like all of us in some way were affected by that in the city, parts of the city, and being shuttled to like different convention centers and safety zones or to our house. And with Yuri, it was just, you know, my neighborhood had no power and water for a week. And in some ways, you know, that was an extreme example. But then there were other folks who didn't have water for, I guess this isn't, you know, exactly what we're talking about, but with flood protection, we've seen really serious conversations in Harris County about how to change the way we prioritize provide flood protection, looking at the human impacts of flooding and prioritizing the worst first and not just making it about the value of homes. And I think that's almost like even looking at the money thing, but kind of changing the way we talk about it. That feels subtle but powerful. And this is where you see the empathy kind of fall away, because that's when often the way it's cast is it's like one neighborhood against another. Whereas like me being in the privileged space of an advocate, I just say like we shouldn't even be, you know, it's all of us deserve flood protection. Let's just make it happen. And I guess these are all just kind of thoughts in progress, so I'm going to pause there.
I just wanted to say real quick that Alicia and I were having a little chat. She got here early before we started, and we were reminiscing about the water crisis 8 years ago. And I was going to tell her that one of my, memory immediately after, and he said, Tom, it was a crisis of confidence. He said, people lost confidence in their local government. We didn't deliver what we were supposed to. And that's just one thing to keep in mind when you have a crisis, that confidence back. I mean, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department did a study 6 weeks later and found that most people weren't giving up bottled water. We talked, my wife still buys bottled water. People not only got used to the improvements that are made, and there's a lot of anxiety people still have today despite the improvements that are made, and it takes a long time. We've had stories of businesses that have, considered and then considered against coming to Toledo because of the perception. And that's one of the things, and I had compared this to the cryptosporidium problem in Milwaukee that happened years earlier, is that perception can be stronger than truth, in that, you know, receptive to providing clean drink from a branding standpoint, people should remember. But let me open this up, and, you know, following normal traditions, we'll take SEJ members first, and, you know, please identify yourself before any. Rico?
Yeah, thank you, Rico Moore, I'm a freelance journalist. Thank you so much for coming here, really appreciate it. So I have a question about specifically the UN human rights regarding water. As a journalist,
is that
for,
do anyone?
For anyone.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I
start with the lawyer.
Yeah, and also I guess the lawyer who my work is so like Houston focused. Just thinking that these represent international norms and values that even if like they're not like an official part of the Clean Water Act and like the legal requirements we're wanting to have enforced, they're like these broader norms that stuff up.
Yeah, so I mean, I would anchor the story, of course, in the laws that we have here, but I would also tie it into the examples that exist in the country and the examples that exist in Africa and South America and a number of other countries, because we have, you know, a lot of times we love to tell someone else what they should be doing, but we fall short ourselves. I remember when the United Nations, they sent a special envoy to Benno. He also shared, you know, there is a crisis in America, just like there is a crisis across the planet in relationship to these issues.
the climate crisis is going to exacerbate both internationally and domestically what's happening inside these communities if we don't, one, strengthen our laws, and there is a current now, and the sense of opportunities that we have in this moment. It's difficult to get people to make the change that's necessary when the resources aren't there to back up great ideas. In this moment, we finally, for the first time in all the time that I've been doing this work, have a set of resources to help us to begin the journey moving forward. And of course, it has to be focused on the places and spaces that need them the most. So when we talk about, $43 billion, that's part of the bipartisan infrastructure package focused on water, we've got a chance, to begin to build infrastructure in certain places and rebuild where it might have existed. We have an opportunity, and this may be more than what you are asking for, but for us to also take a look. So, again, I haven't been in the government in a second. I think it's about 60% of the water violations are usually from small systems. So if we know that, we should be focused. Context to be able to show that when we make the investments that we can lower the impacts that are happening inside of communities. And hopefully we can utilize these models internationally to share with other leaders and countries of what is possible if they don't already have a pathway forward. Because I'm very careful of saying, well, the United States has the answer. So we can share some possibilities of what we're seeing. But of course, each country has to make the decisions that are best for them.
I just want to add really quick. The one way that we were able to use it is looking at what the United Nations had done with the Declaration of Human Rights, as well as the Earth Charter. And that has a direct connection to children rights as well as the environmental justice and how we should engage. And so that's how we were in 3, where we were able to look at the housing issues and how water functions and green infrastructure and the lack of workforce development and how it still impacts our communities of disadvantage or BIPOC communities.
Go ahead.
Nick Hoser from the Algonquin Water Show. A couple of years ago, CNA had actually studied that said that the continuation of water stress could actually send one country or one area into chaos. You would have protests, you would have violence over there in their citizens of clean and sufficient amount of water and reaching the other country. Like Turkey is building 23 major dams that has reduced the amount of water that reaches Syria and Iraq through Tigris and Euphrates. Mm-hmm. Or Iran is blocking a number of its rivers. Afghanistan is actually blocking one major river. So in the future, we will have lots of problems regarding the human right to water, actually, based on politics. And the UN cannot do anything right now. How do you see the future? And how could the journalists actually focus on this matter? Thank you.
The way that we framed it in the community was water was just not water. It was liquid Gulf America. When you look at the fact that people living without water, access to water, are in a public health crisis, that's real. You look at the fact that most of all of COVID, during COVID, you heard, wash your hands. They were out their water because they couldn't afford it. Yet, there were still no mandates of moratoriums on shutoffs. People were still having their water shut off. So look at it from a commerce or a financial gain and pay attention. It is definitely all other things that are happening. Look at how do you frame it as liquid gold. And there's children are seeing it. There's a musical around liquid gold in Milwaukee.
I mean, it has to be a part of our international negotiations and some of the pacts and things that are going to be created. Here's why. The military has been very clear in some of their strategic analyses that both the climate crisis and water are going to be major drivers in wars that are going to happen in and instability that will be a part of this. So if we are not very clear, and here's a couple of different dynamics that are going on. We see it here in this country, and we definitely see it outside of our borders, the privatization of water. I often talk about the governmentization of water. I don't know if that's grammatically correct, but y'all can fix it in a minute. Because there is the dynamic that the brother just shared with us that we have to not wait another 5 or 10 years to begin to White House, to my time at Capitol Hill, to other places. Language without accountability, it is just words. So we've got to think. So we've got COP27 coming up, right? So it is time, one, give more stability across the planet so that, I mean, we see what's going on right now with Russia and Ukraine and how that particular injustice that's happening has created the ripples across the planet. If what we're talking about a tsunami of sets of actions that will create lives and we'll also see, because I've seen it in this country, we'll also see cultures begin to...
Well, I've written a little bit about the global water shortages. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, you know, very simply, the world's population's doubled since the 1960, you know, alinity. And there's been concerns that this century there could be, you know, water wars of, you know, military conflicts over fresh water in certain parts of the world. One thing in doing some research, which is just kind of a nice little anecdote, you know, JFK's most known for, or one of his, you know, things was he was a big, you know, proponent of desalination research. And as it turned out, the 1967 7-day war in the Middle East, it's just kind of an interesting anecdote that I, you know, found in some of my research. But anyways, I'd like to take other questions too. Go ahead and please identify yourself. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm Carol. I look at the Detroit News, and I have a Western League theory question. I wonder what, you know, so like if I write about or I cover the communities that are like sending water to Western Lake Erie, basically, I wonder what the connections, you know, from like the folks in Toledo might want that region to think about, because we don't maybe experience the algal blooms in the same way, but obviously are part of the cycle.
Well, I think you can answer this as well, but I know, born and raised in Detroit and then going off to Toledo, is that there's a commonality, brothers and sisters, in regards to algal blooms, clean and sanitation. And right now Detroit has got some real issues around its water and how our mayor in Detroit is actually dealing with the communities that are in, there was no resolve. And people are suffering the cost of living in a public health crisis connected to water.
I think the other part, we haven't talked much about natural infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And excessive opportunities that exist as a part of a holistic set of actions, mm-hmm. which would also be talk about opportunities to be trying to get people healthier. But we should also talk about the sets of jobs that are part of the equation as well. From a regional perspective, if we do it right, when you look at the conversations, though, or what we used to call Build Back Better and a number of the other pieces, you know, when folks started to not pay attention to the CPC stuff, you know, lower wealth communities have often not played all these different types of positive actions and changes that actually will have long-term benefits both to our health, mm-hmm. helping people to build change, a number of dynamics, and address some of the past disinvestment.
Yeah, and I don't know if this answers your question, Carol, but there, you know, during the height of the water crisis, our governor came, John Kasich at the time, and the governor's office seemed to spin it into, is it because of Western Lake Erie or the Toledo Water Plant, which they had years of kicking the proverbial can down the road. I mentioned the roof falling in, and there was a long history from the agency, and I put in a FOIA for public records on communications between the EPA and the city of Toledo over, they were that motivated, the agency. But he was spinning it into, like, are we being too hard on agriculture? He was protecting the agricultural lobby, and is this a problem with the water treatment plant? I think, you know, at one of the city council meetings, it was 200-year-old water plant or brand pollution at the source, and there were, you know, many engineers I talked to at the put it down deeper in a deeper powder water, what else can we do? And I said, you know, are we going to try to out-engineer the problem, because you guys can probably out-engineer the problem, or is there going to be a commitment to clean up the lake, because it just shouldn't be that way in the first place. So anyways, other questions? Go ahead, please.
Hi, Diana Friesman with Grist. I just want to see if we can talk about climate change for a bit and just ask all the work that you're doing that people are talking about climate change impacts on water, like safety and availability, and whether that's something that the governments, whether like federal or local, are taking seriously right now. Or really anything is kind of being done to prepare for that.
A question like climate change impacts without talking about water. I think definitely in Houston, we're talking, you know, after Hurricane Harvey, there's no denying climate change anymore here. There's still people who maybe don't want to use the word, so they're, you know, or, you know, because the changing weather, or like use euphemisms. Same deal with the winter storm last year. I think both of those, climate change. But in terms of the impacts on water, I don't think, we just don't talk about water very seriously at all yet in Houston. And that's like, you know, part of why my organization does the work it does. I think like after Winter Storm Uri, our focus has been on the lack of water people had. There was a little bit of coverage, but it hasn't been a big part of the discussion. I think where we have talked about water has been more like in the flooding context, and like store sewage is processed, that's been in the shadows.
And for us, we've been focused on urban heat zones and green infrastructure and replacement of trees. So teaching our young people to become stewards already been way too resilient. So we are using community education, because it's not the lack of money, because of the lack of information. And so we're working with local entities like Toledo Grows and Tree Toledo to plant trees. And that's during food and wells where homes have been taken down. So actually having solutions and tying it into workforce development and education for children and their families. So when grant dollars come into Toledo, they're not just impacting the population, they're actually getting down to the people who need them. So instead of cutting grass all the time, put climate change is. So we actually have a community glossary that is connected to climate change. Because don't just keep saying something and I don't know what it is happening.
So let's get some historical context also. The folks saying that folks talking about climate change is something new. You know, Hazel Johnson, who's the mother of the environmental justice movement, she wasn't necessarily calling it climate change, but she was talking about the changes that were happening inside of the climate, and had concerns about how many of these toxic chemicals would play a more impactful role with some of the changes she was seeing. The early indigenous leaders were also talking about it for a while. So the answer is yes. Our folks are most definitely doing it. When we look at the certified animal feeding operations that are happening, and these just amazing rainfalls, huge amounts of precipitation that are impacting that. And of course, my sister talked about flooding along the North Carolina coast and South Carolina a little bit, and up and on the eastern shore of Maryland and North Carolina. When we look at the coal ash pits and lagoons that are around, and people worrying about the breach relationship to that, I can go down a laundry list of things that folks who are working on figure out how we connect more people to these sets of examples of real-life things that are going on to get more people engaged in the changes that we have to make in a very short amount of time.
You have a question here.
Oh, question back here? Go ahead.
Hi, I'm here. I'm a student journalist from Connecticut. It was interesting because you didn't talk about water, and I pulled up the water bottle, and it's full of really clean, fresh water. And I was wondering, how do you guys suggest approaching communities when, as a journalist, when we walk in and sometimes we parachute in these situations, we kind of have a lot of privilege walking into it. So what is the best way to approach these communities from other places?
Understanding that and then helping to kind of illustrate that I understand that when I walk into a community that is struggling to find food and water.
Well, as people are thinking, I'll say, give you a privilege that I know you're on tight timelines and a number of other dynamics you are doing, you have to spend time with folks. The additional set of tools that we have now because of what happened in relationship to COVID give us an opportunity to spend time with folks in ways that our budgets might not have allowed before. You can zoom in, and I would go and I would sit on benches and in the back of pews and a number of other things so that I could actually get a flavor for what was going on in the community. And I would just spend time with folks, and then I would maintain those relationships. And I know we're all busy, but it's one of the ways that there's real authenticity in what's going on. And it also helps to make sure folks know that this is not a transactional relationship. You know, that's something that's so incredibly important, you know. And folks just not going to be pimped anymore. Pimped for their information without anything changing or being done. And we have an opportunity to change that. So we just have to spend time with folks. If we wanted to be real authenticity in what's going on. And we have the ability to do it. I know it's not always easy, but it can be done.
It just reminded me of a great piece of advice I got when I started my first job back at the Bay City. Older guy who was a police reporter, I mean, he, you know, wore the trench coat, looked like Columbo, and the beady eyes and everything. And there was a tradition at the state police department of putting a quarter in a coffee can and having some of their boys. He said, "I don't care how busy you are, there's always going to be work at the office. There's always going to be editors telling you to hurry up and get stuff in." He goes, "You drink their coffee or they won't talk to you." He goes, "You come here, you put a quarter in there, bring a quarter, and you drink their coffee, even if it's only for 5 minutes." You know, so, you know, pretty basic advice, but some of those things still apply in our business.
You know, showing up to a community, I think, also is different when they're in the middle of a crisis. And I guess I just say this, like, with my husband, like, during Harvey, he worked with undocumented to people they can speak to, and he got a lot of requests for, like, okay, we want, like, an undocumented student who's at risk for deportation, whose family had to evacuate from their home, you know, where it's like, I'm not going to connect you to that person. They, like, have other things that they, like, really need moments, like, remembering, like, yeah, just bring that in these moments of crisis, because it's, yeah, really hard in the middle of hurricanes and winter storms, and then when people have additional stressors in their lives, too.
And I just want to add, don't be afraid to protect the narrative, gather their stories. You know, it's not about co-opting the story. It's about lifting the story. Don't let say their names, not because they're laying dead, but because they're living the hardship.
Yeah, and it happens with a lot of, you know, of course, researchers and others. You know, they like it when you immerse yourself in their world. I've visited many different refinery, coal-fired power plant. I said, I just like big stuff. I like to know engineering, how it works, and even if I may not agree with it, I want to, you know what, know how the technology works. But go ahead. Did you have a question? We'll probably have to wrap it.
He sends his regards. We work on the lead projects in the Fifth Ward. And so we spend a lot of time actually knocking on physical doors in Fifth Ward.
Do you want to come up here? You're fine to, you know.
University and Texas Southern University. And Texas A&M's actual study in Fifth Ward on lead contamination, both in the homes and in the water, it went from less than 5%, almost actually 1% response rate on the survey in the Fifth Ward community. Our block captain campaign to physically knock on the doors in our community. And the residents in Fifth Ward, our long-term residents of Fifth Ward, they're the great-grands and the grands of the original slaves and people that founded that community. They're still there. So it's a powerful legacy in this community, what they call ADOS, Texas A&M study documented arsenic both in our water and our soil. We also had a documentation of radioactive chemical in the soil sampling that Texas A&M did. But we still struggle with getting parachute in. They blow back out, and then the stories don't continue to happen. There's no leverage. Our own media system is not supportive in Houston of communities like Fifth Ward, Fourth Ward, period. When you do come in, what we do ask for is when you do parachute in again. Like, come have the boudin, come have greens and collards, and come sit down with us in our communities and keep going. What we do find is lots of people parachute in the Fifth Ward community of Fourth Ward. It is a building that's empty. They collect nonprofit dollars, and those dollars don't get kicked back into the community for anything like and 84% of the schools in Houston have the Legacy Health Clinic out there to do lead testing for the children. And 18% of the schools in Houston HISD have lead. And that's a study from 2017, and nobody's doing anything. There's no pressure. And we also have a literacy issue, like a reading literacy issue. We're the lowest literacy rate in the city in Fifth Ward. So you're not going to really see our community write an article or an op-ed. So we do need your support. So do parachute in, help us write an op-ed and continue to write op-eds, and then bring other reporters in so that the city of Chicago, for example, parachute in, get the story, the byline, and burn back out. And then we're still stuck there dealing every day with the fact that we have lead contamination. You know, I have lead contamination. I was exposed to it, and I now am on the autism spectrum or ADHD. And my brother has that as well, too. We didn't know that the stuff we were picking off the house and playing with.
That's right.
My parents didn't know. They're not educated communities that we face. So we have like chlorine, we have disinfected byproducts, pesticides, chromium 6, obviously the high levels of lead, arsenic, PFAS in our waters. And nobody's talked to us about water filtration system. No one's talked to us about how to clean up the water. How do we afford it? We're all on poverty line. All of us, including myself, we're all on poverty line. And it's a half-and-half community, so it's Spanish and English as well, too. So there's a language justice issue happening in our community where people are not getting this information at all in Spanish. And we really try hard with Reverend Caldwell to feel like we were saying in front of the board. Just come back. The other challenge is to kind of dial back to the standard of the... But then you have organizations like Reverend Caldwell, who's a longtime resident, he's 70-something years old, and he's been in this community forever. And his organizations and other organizations are missed. And we have nonprofits, like Rochelle's on a nonprofit. She's also in another organization with her and her called Fair Housing Neighborhood Rights. They're not able to get their own personal money, and they're impoverished to get them into housing. So there's a lot of stories, underlying stories, that are missed. Such great, powerful stories. Like, we're paying for hotels right now for 5 families who are homeless. They're all 3 single moms, 5 kids each, all homeless. And the HISD is doing nothing to help them or support them. Like, there's so many great transitional stories, but also opportunities to put spotlights on some of the major issues that you've all been dialing in on and talking about in the community. So it's just such a powerful... I feel hopeful being here as a member and as a student that you all 700 of y'all showed up here and took an interest and you care. Care about Fifth Ward, you care about First Ward, and if I will go back to Fifth Ward and say 700 people showed up here in Houston and they're going to talk about what they saw here, and we're going to see a huge lift of this. So thank you for coming to our city, thank you for listening to us, and thank you for doing all the work that you continue to do everywhere you are.
Thank you, Danielle. I'm glad you stood up and said that. I had just a wonderful conversation with Reverend Caldwell when he agreed to come. I was looking forward to meeting him. I understand, you know, his personal situation, and please give him my regards because he was very excited about this opportunity. So please pass along my regards. Guys, coming. Thanks.
Thank you.